Once Upon a Time by Ethel Seaman, read by Cahoe.
Part 1. Infinity is incomprehensible. The weekly briefings Rodney emails through the gate go about as well as ever. Rodney types up minutely detailed briefs on how exactly they need to intercede on at least a half dozen planets to prevent the Jedi from getting a beachhead in several societies with at least early modern cultures. For God's sake, the Venorians have synthesized a petroleum-type product and invented the internal combustion engine. And all he gets back are queries about Atlantis tech and admonitions to explore Atlantis more thoroughly. He isn't sure that they truly comprehend the statement Weir is captured by a hostile army of fascist whack jobs, even though Landry swears his first language is English. Technically, with Weir in some Jedi hell prison, Carson is in charge. He happily ignores this fact and sticks to the infirmary even more than ever. That leaves Rodney and John in charge, nominally, but Rodney can't focus on his real work and also administer to the day-to-day tedium of keeping the city running, which basically means Atlantis has become a bureaucratic nightmare. The Daedalus arrives in orbit to disgorge another bright-eyed bunch of idealistic morons, hell-bent to be the best in their respective fields, whether that be nut collecting or underwear cataloging or monkey classification. Rodney and John and Raddick and Jeanette Hero sit around the conference table with Caldwell and swear up and down they don't need a replacement for Weir. They are managing fine and dandy. But troops, those, maybe, they could really use. Over and over again, the idiots in the oversight committee refuse anything but civilian aid, and over again, Rodney can feel the inevitability of it all constricting around him. His death will be caused by the politics of another galaxy. The Daedalus departs, and the new recruits are given the rundown. This is how you think things are supposed to happen. This is how things are really going to happen. Generally, it's Elizabeth who gives these debriefings. Now, John does it. Rodney thinks the fact that John is armed at all times helps with imparting the, what would you call it? The gravity of the situation. We are at war. You might have missed that in all your little meetings with General Landry or General O'Neill or whoever it was back on Earth that recruited you, with chances of a lifetime and all that crap. We have two objectives. One is to get back Dr. Elizabeth Weir from the Jedi, and the second is to stay alive. In that order. If you have an issue with these directives or the order in which they are implemented, then when the Daedalus returns in a few months, if you're still alive, don't let the whooshing of the gate hit you in the ass as you depart. Alrighty? Fabulous. The actual administration of Atlantis is mainly a scienceocracy, because, even if it pains him to admit it, Zelika is the most competent person that Rodney knows. So Rodney just dropped the daily grind right in Raddick's lap and let him pick and choose who would be in charge of procuring food and making sure Carson doesn't kill them all with some virus or making the chore chart or whatever. Naturally, like a liquid seeking equilibrium, the management of the city fell together in the vacuum of Elizabeth's absence with Taylor and Ronan as the shadow cabinet for Rodney and John. Taylor sees that people smoothly integrate and puts out the brush fires of daily living. Ronan trains civilians to become a civil guard. Rodney plots and plans and makes elaborate diagrams and charts. John seeks a sort of militant solitude that Rodney figures has a lot to do with blaming himself and a short spiral into madness. His hair has certainly withstood the new regime. The whole shebang started as a joke, a way to pass the time in all the creeping hours between off-world deployments and Jedi attacks. This is Nima Al-Hadi and... A smooth, deep female voice with a crisp GTA Canadian accent bleeps through 100 old headsets. This is Sarah Golden, cuts in a higher, Western American accent. And this is the Atlantis podcast, both voices finish together. A warbled, off-tune singing floats into the collective ear of Atlantis, instantly recognizable to one and all. Somewhere in Lab Fermi, an annoyed squeak cuts off the burbling laughter of a dozen physicists. Dr. Rodney McKay serenades the city with a heartfelt rendition of Ahead by a Century by the Tragically Hip, interspersed with random commentary on himself. By at least a century, if not two, ahead by a millennium compared to those dolts in botany. End life. Landry wouldn't know a fucking emergency if it stepped up and bit his dick off. And the universe. The expanding universe model is a joke. Ha! The laugh will be on those morons in a couple billion years. And everything. God, this is all so pointless. Even though it started as a joke and remains, mainly, a lighthearted point in everyone's week, there are deeper truths contained in the Atlantis podcast. Lessons in camaraderie in the face of disaster, of community, of belonging. Everyone fears and delights in the moment they will be casually recorded counting off how much they hate Dr. McKay, or details of their torrid sex fantasies about Ronan, about how gay they think Colonel Shepard is, or how unstable, about the time Dr. Weir saved them the last dish of melon, or Zelenka praised their quick thinking. The podcast is really about solidarity, even if it seems on the surface to be about Dr. Al-Hadi, Ph.D. in microbiology and chemistry, Canada, and Dr. Golden, Ph.D. in anatomy and physiology, Maryland, USA, mocking everything in Atlantis from the petrified plants to the lack of fish in their diet when they live in the middle of an ocean. Everyone has, or will, appear in the podcast to be lampooned or ridiculed, and that's a welcome constant in a life full of chaos and uncertainty. What did our minions find for us this week, Nim? Sarah says, as dozens of Tauri in the home of the ancients mouth along. With that salvo, the voice of Lieutenant Colonel John Shepard, USAF, cuts in, as if in direct response. I don't know what the hell they found, but I bet all of Rodney's jello rations for a month to find out how they do actual recordings and where they hide the mics. If you asked really sweetly, Colonel Shepard, I'm sure one of our recording agents would happily give you a hands-on demonstration of their subterfuge techniques, Dr. Al-Hadi murmurs like a phone sex worker. If he let me show him, I'd give him our entire list of agents, Nim. The women laugh a bumper to the next bit of embarrassing conversation amongst the recently off-world geology team, disclosing how they set themselves on fire with some kind of alien pebbles. Rodney pinpoints the exact moment it all went to hell as when the Jedi got their hands on the first nuclear device. How they had never figured out how to make a clean version themselves and yet reverse-engineered the one they stole so successfully is beyond him. Okay, that's rhetorical. Not much is really beyond him. Witness his crash course in military strategy. Who would ever think that marching into the Arctic Circle in the wintertime was a good idea when one's clothes are held together by brass buttons? Rodney lifts his chin and watches John tapping out Morse code on the counter, eyes vague, inner eye watching something far away. John taps "fuck the SGC" over and over. Rodney thinks about Russia in the wintertime, about discovering his Canadianness in Siberia, of learning what a crock the idealized collective memory of pioneer days was hundreds of years after his forebears sought the Northwest Passage while sitting in a concrete and rebar building typing in Cyrillic and thinking that +5 degrees would be heaven. Rodney remembers looking at ice blue like a baby blanket and thinking about Oak Park in the dead of winter, standing in his parents' yard in jeans and a light jacket, collating super collider data in his head with the taste of Tim Horton's coffee sitting like a sour ghost in his mouth. "Where were you born?" Rodney asks John. Shepard looks up at him, breaks off in the middle of tapping out E. The vague is gone from him instantaneously. Rodney knows the edge that John's round cheeks and cheeky circumventing of authorities hides is the real John. Rodney is still waiting to meet the real Meredith Rodney McKay, but he knows the real Lieutenant Colonel John Shepard pretty well. On base at Edwards, he doesn't say anything else. He doesn't ask why Rodney wants to know. They stare at each other for a second. The Air Force is home, or it was. He didn't have to say that, either part of it. Rodney knows he won't ever feel the same about the ROM or City TV either. It took him until well past 30 to find out what being Canadian truly meant, and then he started back at ground zero when he came to Atlantis with identification through place, through citizenship. Even in the Dark Ages, you'd think they had a working grasp of the fact that metal freezes in the cold. Rodney turns back to his chart of the sector, the Jedi consolidating, and begins to tune out the world. Strictly speaking, I believe the Napoleonic Wars were considered early modern, not so much Dark Ages, Rodney. He begins to tap again. Home. And then Rodney sees a pattern to the Jedi's recent activities. He sees the pattern, but he doesn't recognize it. Oh. Grabbing someone's crotch is a good confusion tactic. Ronan's voice rumbles over a techno beat, a bass line twisting around his words and the humor in his delivery brightened and augmented by a fluttering laugh track and beat to the reverb top line. The song plays as a standard introduction to a Ronan piece on the podcast. Ronan's voice kicks back in. Yeah, there's no coming back from being skinned alive. That bon mot is bumpered by the song continuing where it left off. Elizabeth was taken right from the gate room. There isn't a person who was on the mission when the Jedi stormed in and killed 15 of them and snatched Elizabeth who doesn't blame themselves personally. Rodney's heard the murmurs, recognized the poleaxe expressions of shock and fear. John, Rodney, Ronan, and Taylor were off-world when the Jedi invaded. There is a universal consensus that this was timed. There is also a pervasive paranoia that perhaps they have a mole in the city. No one wants to believe this because the sense of family amongst the deployed is real, is vital, is part of who they are, each as individuals, but all the same, one cannot overlook the reality and replace it with a hollow sense of how things ought to be. They've all learned that lesson as individuals as well. Rodney isn't the same person who stepped through the gate into the Pegasus Galaxy. Since he believes in the infinite worlds model, he actually doesn't believe he's the same person as he was when he decided to have cereal for breakfast instead of oatmeal. But that's neither here nor there. He's fundamentally a different person now, and he knows that in small ways, like the fact that he knows how to fire an automatic weapon without shooting his own face off, and the fact that he doesn't always expect anyone to listen to everything he says, even if he is right 99.999 plus infinity percent of the time. And in large ways, like the fact that he notices things about other people, things like how transparent their feelings are when you really look. Rodney worries about other people as much as himself now, and for that reason he hopes the Jedi don't really have a spy amongst them, because he knows John will kill whoever it is, slowly, painfully. And that will precipitate John becoming a person Rodney doesn't ever want him to become. Major Lauren Tells It Like It is a favorite podcast feature. He is one of the few guests who are solicited, which means he actually knows he's being recorded. There's an Ethosian basket in the mess that people drop questions for Major Lauren into. He reads the ones that take his fancy and answers them with his usual elan. One of you crackpots wrote in to me, "Major Lauren, is it healthy for me to daydream about establishing my own nation on an isolated Pegasus planet and have the inhabitants worship me and feed me fruit while I somehow, through the magic of science, watch reruns of Charles in Charge all day?" Major Lauren's laughter causes him to choke and cough. "Man, that's the best you could do? I have more detailed fantasies about the Ethosian girl I helped birth her sheep, or whatever it was called, last week." The problem with the Jedi is that they are rudimentary in both their technology and their tactics. Rodney has a hard time dumbing himself down to their level, and when he says so, he elicits guffaws and elbowing amongst the peanut gallery. Using radiation to defeat your enemies is counterintuitive, since that leaves the environment uninhabitable by you. "How am I supposed to think on the level of people who would see this as an adequate outcome?" Rodney protests. Raddick ignores him completely. Carson rubs his eyes and sighs. John thumps his thumb against the meeting table and stares directly into Rodney's eyes. "Maybe you need to reevaluate what winning means in this context." Rodney already knows that, and he pops open his mouth to declare it in a scathing manner when it occurs to him that John is not talking about the Jedi at all. Rodney snaps his mouth closed, his teeth clicking together in an uncomfortable way, and tilts his head to observe John. He doesn't like to think of them being the kind of people who have no limits, who disregard the Geneva Conventions and basic human morality. He doesn't like to think of them being in a war, either, and he can admit that sometimes his thinking is bounded in by constraints he imposes because he's never had to work outside of their strictures. Rodney reassesses. His mind shifts, one thought shoved up against and writing the next. "Right, then I say we blow up the underground bunkers on the Jedi homeworld. We make that a statement." He lifts his chin and watches John's blank face. "What if that's where Elizabeth is being held?" Carson sits up straighter, fidgeting with the data pad in front of him. "Clearly, if you have eyes, you can see that Elizabeth is in a wooden structure in the videos." Raddick clears his throat. "I agree. This place where she is being held is not underground. Unless this is elaborate ruse, there was a window." John stands, slapping both palms against the glossy surface of the table. "Let's do this. Rodney, use your brain. We won't wear any brass buttons, just in case." Dude, seriously. I was on SG-8 before I came to Pegasus, and Shepard isn't any stupider than O'Neill. But we also don't have Daniel Jackson. Background noises twist around the statements. Metal on stone, possibly. The female voice is light, mid-American. Oh, please. Ronan's way hotter than Dr. Jackson. He has a neck tattoo. The scraping is closer. The answering voice is male, suffused with laughter. I never said I wouldn't go a couple of rounds with Ronan in a supply closet. Dr. Al-Hadi cuts in. This round of who's hotter, Daniel Jackson or Ronan Dex, goes to Ronan. Next up, whose jokes are lamer, General O'Neill or Colonel Shepard? Dr. Golden snaps her gum in everyone's ears. Okay. Rodney stands in front of the assembled military personnel of Atlantis, comfortable in his black battle dress and tack vest. He clasps his hands behind his back and paces in front of the soldiers. The bottom line of this mission is, save Elizabeth, don't die. That is easy even for the Marines to remember. People actually laugh at his joke, and he smiles, warming to the room. The more complex version goes like this. Units 2 through 5 will kill any Genii they encounter while the tactical team will plant the explosives. Everyone will now get a simple rundown on how the bombs work and how to disarm them. They had learned early on that it's best to give everyone all the instructions in case too many people get killed and people have to be pulled off of different duties to fill in for key positions. I'm not sure that zippity-doo-dah being piped into a prisoner's cell is strictly contravening the Geneva Conventions, no, Dr. Beckett says in a completely conversational tone. What about It's a Small World? Lieutenant Cadman queries. That, well, yes, I think that would be considered torture. There's a snapping that might be latex gloves being donned. Battle always plays itself back in freeze frame in Rodney's memories. The activity itself is the closest he ever comes to life moving as quickly as his thoughts. He has to focus on one thing, wiring or ancient crystals or holding pressure on a gushing wound, and his words come unfiltered, even by the tissue-thin filters he utilizes in normal scenarios. Rodney remembers saying things like, "Duck!" and, "Wow, that was amazing, Major!" and, "I'll pull the trigger if you move." He remembers flickering bunker lights and whitewashed moonlight, faces clicking by like a slideshow, shock, pain, confusion, determination. The important thing is that he remembers. Whether that's a positive or a negative depends on whether he remembers how brave Sergeant Mathis was as Kalia held the gun to her head point blank and pulled the trigger, or how faded and defeated John looked as the bunkers blew. Someone has to remember Sergeant Mathis. It might as well be Rodney who remembers her in delicate precision. John, well, Rodney would have that one removed by Wolfram and Hart if he could, because Rodney can only be rah-rah pep rally guy for one, and he needs to do it for himself. Elizabeth wasn't there. Oh, Rodney really hopes she wasn't there. Kalia got away. Rodney wonders which of those facts is more important to John at this point. Dr. McKay sings, clearly, to himself.
In the meadow we can build a snowman and pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, "Are you married?" We'll say, "No, man, but you can do the job when you're in town."
"What's a snowman?" Ronan interjects. Dr. McKay gives a startled screech, everyone in Atlantis picturing him with his hand clutched to his chest and mouth wide open. "It's a man made of snow, you barbarian," he harumphs. "You have people made of crystallized water on Earth?" "No, you build it. Well, not you. People. Usually children. It's a leisure time activity. You make a face for it out of rocks, or, in stories, it's usually coal, and you already know this. I have better things to do than being tormented by mountain men being taken away from my strategic strategizing." Ronan laughs. "I saw them on the box. Didn't know they were songs, though." Rodney knows when they find the message on M3G-647 that he's standing on a pivotal point in his life. Pegasus is full of these moments in a way that Rodney never felt on Earth. He always saw in retrospect there, always perfect hindsight. But in Atlantis, on planets and Pegasus, Rodney often feels prescient, like he can see so clearly how his life is splitting off into splinter realities all around him. There's a world where this is just a quiet Christmas Eve on Atlantis, and Rodney is sipping faux cider laced with a Thosian brandy, watching hockey shipped over on the Daedalus. There's a world where Rodney hadn't gone on the mission, where he's too busy and Raddick or Simpson have gone instead. And in that, those worlds, John has no catalyst, no smart-ass remark to react to realign him inside. Sadly, in Rodney's own reality, when they walk through the door to Picard's house and find the girl on the floor, neck bent at a strange angle and shirt rucked up to her waist, Rodney blurts out, "Oh God, Elizabeth!" and watches as the line of John's shoulders change, straightening from his falsely casual slouch. Rodney sees Elizabeth's face laid over the waxy skin and fine bones of the girl, and wonders what worse has been done to her. The Christmas podcast is just music. Rodney becomes frantic when the messages become more and more frequent. Their trading partners experience in what John offhandedly calls collateral damage in a pattern that isn't one. A favored daughter raped on Vevnos. The domesticated animals poisoned in Vesnia. Radiation poisoning in the wells in three towns on Raymer. John falls silent. Rodney's grandmother would say he eats the death like stones. Rodney used to imagine, as a child, a person with a belly full of rocks, the stones sticking together as he moved. Now, well, he actually understands the metaphor and imagines John's inside solidifying, petrifying. Rodney has charts and plans, and he works himself to sleep, a couple hours every couple days, crashing out on top of star maps and scribbled notes about World War I. He dreams of living fractals and John as a boy. John as a boy likes the Green Lantern because he was a pilot, and won't eat bananas or anything yellow because it cancels out the lantern's powers. Rodney talks to young John in his dreams, tells him about his family's cottage in Kawarthas, about how big a waste of time he'd always thought canoeing and barbecuing was as a boy, how much he wishes he could find that feeling of security he felt every night falling asleep in the loft with Jeannie scribbling in her diary by flashlight. New Year's arrives with well wishes through the gate and word the Daedalus will arrive on schedule. As of New Year's Day, Elizabeth has been in Janai hands for 4 months. Rodney doesn't make any resolutions. He never does, but he pointedly doesn't this year. Besides, Atlantis's planet orbits their sun in a different trajectory than Earth, and it's really not even a new year in Atlantis. The next podcast is start to finish without a single word of English. Dr. Al-Hadi speaks in Arabic with a pronounced Lebanese accent, and Dr. Golden answers in Yiddish. The ambient conversations are in Czech, French, Spanish, Russian, and Mandarin. Dr. McKay sings,
Marie-Claire, j'ai salé beaucoup de poissons, et les bois du Nord maintenant sont tranquilles. Je te promets de ne pas boire la boisson. Oublie le Montréal, la vieille ville.
Dr. Beckett converses in Scottish accented Czech with Dr. Simpson and Dr. Zelenka. Rodney's recalibrating the interface between his laptop and the main ancient power board in the gate room when her body falls through the event horizon. He's faster than he used to be, and he's on comms before anyone else. Carson to the gate room, stat. He doesn't know why he says stat, except it seems like what people say in medical emergencies. He slides the last foot on his knees, reaching out for Elizabeth's body, for the note, reading without comprehension. We are at an impasse, in heavy, combative script. Ancient, devolved, like Latin into Italian, he thinks those things. Thinks them and looks down at Elizabeth's gaunt, bruised face and realizes he has to move her before John comes through the door to the gate room. Rodney carries her, all 100 or so pounds of her, past the stunned Marines and gaping gate room staff. He takes a route he knows John wouldn't. He meets Carson halfway and they jog to the infirmary together in silence. They have her dressed in scrubs and her face cleaned off before John floats into the room, silent, dressed in black, like a ninja, Rodney thinks, his pre-Atlantis brain reinstating itself out of self-preservation, and looks down at her. Atlantis pivots around John in that second, and Rodney can see it like he can see the parts of an atom dance in his mind, like he can see the music of the spheres so perfectly defined in the precision he calls physics and the ancients call truth. The podcast is suspended while Colonel Caldwell is in Atlantis, delivering Dr. Jackson to his new posting as Atlantis' chief civilian. Part 2. Bureaucracy's a drag. International Oversight Advisory Internal Memo to IOA, etc. From Blacked Out. Date, Blacked Out. This list, number 36. Report number 1. Eyes only printout. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. I do not know why I have to type up these reports. Isn't there some kind of technology available the SDC could utilize which would record my voice rather than shackle me to this computer while massive portions of the city have yet to be explored and there is an entire galaxy full of potential ancient settlements to be evacuated? I suppose that sentence could have been punctuated with a question mark, but, since it was sarcastic, I choose to make it a statement meant to be indicative of my annoyance. To abbreviate this pointless exercise, I will make this as concise as possible. The math and physics teams have not killed anyone or blown anything up this week. Lieutenant Colonel John Shepard was not shot or injured in any way I saw, although I was on M9T-743 for several days. I suppose he could have lost an eye during that time and regrown it while I was away. M9T-743, also known as Cilicia, has culture analogous to Mesopotamian city-states and uses a form of ancient I've never encountered previously. They have no weapons, so I suppose no one cares but me. The most notable feature of brief tenure here has been the marked lack of morale among the expedition members, which is to be expected in attendance of the death of the remarkable woman who had been and continues to be held in the highest esteem by her colleagues. I cannot presage what ultimate impact this event will have upon the spirit of the Atlantis personnel. The Genii have not attacked. Dr. McKay says that pudding always cheers people up. Daniel Jackson, Atlantis Expedition Leader. Wow, that's pretty amazing to see in print. International Oversight Advisory Internal Memo to IOA, etc. From Blacked Out. Date, Blacked Out. This list number 36. Report number 2. Eyes only printout. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. 2 days ago, one of the exploratory teams, led by Dr. Hiragawa, found a room in one of the south towers with this writing on the wall. Most of the staff has some proficiency in ancient, although perhaps proficiency is too strong a word. They at least recognize the language when it falls on their heads in stone form, or when they chirp into something akin to a dry well due to disregard of the symbols. At any rate, as anyone who can actually read ancient will know, and if anyone reading this report can read ancient, I will be thrilled and amazed. This reads, "Do not enter." I would like to propose that all future personnel detached to the Atlantis expedition be inculcated with this specific arrangement of symbols and given electroshock as a Pavlovian sensory response modification to teach them to avoid this warning at all costs. If you were ever interested in the causality relation between amnesia and hidden personal truths, we have footage. Why the ancients built a device which erased exactly 6 months from people's memories is a mystery of the ancients. Daniel Jackson, head of the circus called the Atlantis Expedition. International Oversight Advisory Internal Memo to IOA, etc. From Blacked Out. Date, Blacked Out. This list number 36. Report number 3. Eyes only printout. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. Read your last missive. If by tone you mean that my reports reflect my actual feelings and basic humanity and personality, then the only way I could modify it would be to pretend to be something I am not, such as a robot or a lemur. Lemurs probably have no true grasp of fundamentals of typing, but I'm sure you could find a robot who would type up reports about one of the greatest endeavors of human history in an unbiased and impersonal way. Perhaps this will be a good side project for Dr. Lee to apply himself to. Read the expedition. No Genii attacks, no new bombs found, we are out of popcorn. Daniel Jackson, human being, not lemur. Deep Space Telemetry Project, 2 Jack, CC blanked out. From Daniel, date blacked out, report number 1. Eyes only printout. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. While morale is predictably low, all members of the expedition appear to be functioning in their assigned capacities in a normal and acceptable manner. It is my belief that Lieutenant Colonel Shepard has the respect and devotion of the entire military detachment of the expedition, and that his removal or replacement at this time would further destabilize the situation and could lead unneeded resentment amongst the military and non-military personnel of the expedition. Dr. McKay has been something of the revelation. Either my interactions with him on Earth were not indicative of his actual personality, or this mission has radically altered him. He is an invaluable resource to this expedition, and, while not the most placid of personalities, he has the trust of the veterans of Atlantis. Dr. Beckett and I have had very little interaction, as I have managed to stay hale and unharmed during the few days I have been in the Pegasus Galaxy. He appears to be subdued and possibly in personal mourning for Dr. Weir. At this time, I do not advise his removal or demotion, not only because Atlantis needs to maintain as many ATA gene carriers as possible, but also because I have no real reason to believe he is not functioning at his full capacity. The specific department heads fall under the purview of either Lieutenant Colonel Shepard or one of the science team, and I leave their assessment to those who have been here longer and know their usual behavior. My assessment of the Genii situation is that they are a grave danger to this expedition, and the reports logged by Dr. Weir and the other Atlantis members have not been overstating the situation. On M7X744, I witnessed firsthand 2 moderately sized villages razed to the ground and the effects of radiation poisoning on the populace. See attached field report. Whether my initial perceptions of the situation are correct will be borne out by time. Exploration of the city has recommenced, and we are working on a grid pattern beginning in the South Pier in the tower referred to by the expedition members as Rapunzel's Tower. Daniel Jackson. Deep Space Telemetry Project. 2 Jack. CC blacked out. From Daniel. Date blacked out. Report number 2. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. Due to the lack of ancient education among the staff of the expedition, yesterday an exploration team led by Dr. Hiragawa, consisting of her, Dr. Valerie, Dr. Thompson, and Major Williams, opened a lab which contained an ancient device, the purpose of which appears to be erasing 6 months of memory from anyone targeted by a beam of light emitted from the side of the device. Those ultimately affected: Dr. Hiragawa, Dr. Thompson, Lieutenant Colonel Shepard. There is dispute as to whether the device was activated by Lieutenant Colonel Shepard or Dr. Hiragawa. See attached reports from all involved personnel. The medical teams are working on a remedy through organic means. Other science teams are working on the mechanics of the device itself, led by Dr. McKay. Once all countermeasures are exhausted, the device will be sent back to SGC on board the Daedalus. The below configuration of Ancient appears to be the standard warning for potentially dangerous areas of Atlantis. I have implemented a training seminar in which all expedition members are taught recognition of the warning. Daniel Jackson. Deep Space Telemetry Project. To Jack, CC blacked out. From Daniel, date blacked out. Report number 2. Eyes only printout. Classified. Due to the sensitive nature of this report, the pages that do not pertain directly to your purview have been removed by the administration. The contents you are allowed access to has not been edited. You are required to destroy this document after reviewing it. It is my belief that my tenure in Atlantis will be of limited duration due to the vicissitudes of the IOA's collective wind. During my time here, I plan to maximize the chances of finding ancient technology that will benefit Earth and its future confrontations with the Ori. To this end, I have systemized the exploration of the city to be round-the-clock in shifts led by team captains carrying the ATA gene. It is my belief that even if I am removed from this position, Lieutenant Colonel Shepard will continue this regime under new civilian leadership. Daniel Jackson. Part 3. Life is change. Death is the absence of anything. Rodney isn't resistant to change. He sees life as a sort of Heraclitean river where all exists and doesn't exist at once. For every particle, there's an opposite particle, and at the same time, there are no particles and no opposites. His life is the flux, so he reserves his vexation for the small, insignificant, to other people, things in life like popcorn husks and his molars and the idiocy of others. He doesn't resist change when it comes because he doesn't think of the static, doesn't expect his bed to exist at the end of the day, and doesn't expect gravity to necessarily work in a constant and universal manner, even with his outward protestations of such. He's a complex guy. The new regime, as the podcast calls it, really is a lot more of the same. Daniel Jackson, PhD, PhD, DI, dithering idiot, is very hands-off and doesn't have much to say about how they run the ins and outs of life on Atlantis. Or, rather, how Zelenka and Jeanette and Taylor and Ronan run the ins and outs of life on Atlantis, and Rodney and John report back to Daniel about it. The exploration of the city is far more concerted and directed. Rodney has more artifacts to examine, less time to worry about the Janai, and much less time to think about what happened. But he still sleeps 3 hours a night, maybe, and eats power bars in the lab and sings to himself when he's onto something big, something huge. John leads off-world missions to scout for dig sites for Jackson. Rodney thinks the loss of his memory and the reinstatement might have been, how would he put it? Utterly soul-destroying. If Rodney believed in souls, which, strictly speaking in the theological sense, he very much does not, John's metaphorical soul, that sounds too much like psychology magical realism. John is not okay. Late one night, as Rodney's working on calibrating an ancient device that produces several frequencies of sonic pulse to another device that emits UV bursts, he realizes that maybe John had never really been okay in the way Rodney understands the catch-all, nearly meaningless word. Rodney's okay means time for research that isn't mind-numbing, citrus-free snacks late at night, the sense of accomplishment when he fades from fully aware to dissociating himself into sleep that he's lifted the veil a little that day and seen into something larger than his own life. Rodney has been fairly okay in Atlantis, with some spectacular exceptions. Men like John, men who are silent, who smile not because they are pleased but in order to conceal that they are not, Rodney has seen that all his life, but he's always dismissed it as the life of quiet desperation and gone back to his notes. Rodney doesn't dismiss it when John pretends away any mentions of Elizabeth and spends the hours he should be sleeping sitting in Rodney's lab, doing paperwork with tired eyes and his hair in more of a disarray than usual. John's hair is getting long and his mouth droops at the corners from exhaustion often. Egypt by Kate Bush trails away and the soft sound of someone bumping a finger against a mic cuts through the silence. Hello? A pause is filled with rustling fabric and a deep sigh. This is Daniel Jackson. The doctors who... broadcast this show have asked me to say a few words. Well, they asked me to sing, but I told them I've heard a few of the previous shows and I don't want to steal the limelight from Dr. McKay. Atlantis either sighs dreamily or, in the case of Dr. McKay, flips off its headset. Rodney is still on the team. He puts down his research and straps on a tack vest and crams power bars and sugar cubes into the pockets in case for when they get kidnapped, stranded. He complains because complainito, ergo Rodney, but it's more ingrained habit, the words falling out of his mouth without any real annoyance behind them. John smiles lopsidedly and says things like, "Don't strain your spleen with your grousing, Rodney," and "I've seen more threatening inhabitants in the Magic Kingdom, McKay," and "It's pointless anyway. We're not going to find a fucking ZPM, and you know it." It's the last sort of remark, vehement in its bleakness, that causes Rodney to exchange looks with Taylor and Ronan. Taylor's face becomes more placid, devoid of any expression whatsoever that indicates she's upset. Not the hard set of her forehead that marks anger, but the softening that denotes wariness. Ronan pushes his shoulders back, balancing on his heels when John says things like that. He lifts his chin and looks down at Rodney and Taylor along the straight line of his nose. Ronan probably knows more about overcoming futility than any of them, even Taylor, who at least always had her people through the worst moments. Rodney doesn't know when he became the kind of person who has silent conversations with people, who recognizes subtle shifts in mood by the line of someone's shoulders or the exact way they sigh. He compares it to the pattern recognition in complex mathematics, though, something his mind does instinctively. He wonders if he always had the ability to recognize someone's bad days, someone's sorrow in the way their mouth turns down and they cock their hip. Probably not. Probably got that from some Pegasus infection they don't even know about. Human medicine hasn't advanced much in the last few centuries. He read those voodoo practitioners are using leeches again. Listen, I might do a special episode where I read all of your porned-out fantasies about Dr. Jackson and then speculate on who I think wrote which, if you don't stop leaving your totally obvious come-ons reworded as questions to me in the Athosian basket of Lornosity. Got it? Major Lorne pauses. Glass connects with the solid surface. So, PSA over with. Dear Major Lorne, are the residents of the Pegasus Galaxy the same species as we are, strictly speaking? That is to say, would sleeping with someone, say an Athosian, be considered some kind of sexual deviancy? If it's not deviant, you're not putting your back into it, is what I say. Carson has this way of just annoying the hell out of Rodney. What? Rodney swivels around in his chair and watches as Carson drops his fluttering hands to his hip, his entire demeanor changing from wish-washy buffoon to hard-edged professional. Rodney has a way of annoying the hell out of Carson back. It's their impasse. You don't have to scream, Rodney. Carson talks to Rodney like a grade 5 teacher. Rodney skipped grade 5. What do you want, Dr. Killjoy? I've got things to fix and galaxies to save. Rodney turns back around, childishly pleased to present Carson his slumped shoulders of disdain. I need to speak with you about Colonel Shepard. Carson steps closer into Rodney's 3-foot bubble of personal space. And? Rodney doesn't turn around. He doesn't trust himself to not betray John with his face. As much as they all trust Beckett, when it comes down to GSWs and ancient plagues, this is something else, something Rodney feels isn't Carson's business. This is between the team, between John and Rodney and Taylor and Ronan. You know what I'm talking about, Rodney? Carson's tired, washed out and weary, as much as the rest of them. He took Elizabeth's death personally. Rodney knows that, but Rodney isn't Carson's support system. They don't talk about feelings and shared guilt. Well, Carson talks about that stuff all the time, but Rodney generally shuts his ears and thinks of England. I'm sure I don't know what you mean, Rodney sniffs. I think he might need to be relieved of duty, Rodney. He sighs around the words, duty coming out like duty, like Rodney's Uncle Gord. He won't see Heitmeyer. This is all Rodney is going to concede. He won't say only Elizabeth could have gotten either of us in there, but he doesn't have to. I can have him relieved of duty, you know that. Rodney knows it. He also knows Carson wouldn't be here, pleading with Rodney to intervene if he was going to do that. I thought he could work through this on his own, like... Carson pauses, obviously wondering what Rodney knows and doesn't know from John's personnel file. Like he did after Afghanistan, yeah, I know, Carson. I'll deal with it. He tunes Carson out then, typing in ancient, focusing by picturing Feynman diagrams. He sees swirls and dots overlaid on John's face the night Elizabeth was tossed through the gate like a dead animal, the tears that never came, the lines by his eyes deep in the blue spectrum light of the infirmary. Rodney remembers John's hands resting on the blanket over Elizabeth's body, the scars on his knuckles and the deeper one on the back of his wrist that showed suture marks along the side. "What did you put in for from the dead list this time, Sarah?" Dr. Al-Hadi cuts in over a recording of the Thosian pipes. Dr. Golden groans. "Naturally, you'd ask that, since I requisitioned tampons of the non-standard issue Rip Apart My Insides brand." "I should have thought of that." Dr. Al-Hadi laughs burnished copper rumbles. "You?" "Cigarettes to trade the Marines for other contraband." Both women laugh. "Well, if we're getting drunk, maybe I won't need those tampons next month." Somewhere in the infirmary, Dr. Beckett does not laugh, a sour look on his usually pleasant face. John's lurking in Rodney's lab like he usually is when he's not on a city exploration team or running the soldiers through mock invasion scenarios with Ronan and Lorne. He's reading emails on the intranet with a running commentary track. "You have got to be kidding. Like, I don't know why they want to requisition the grain?" Rodney smiles and bleeds a little laugh out. He's already fiddled with some numbers to facilitate that endeavor. Zelenka makes the best faux apricot brandy in two galaxies, but sometimes a man needs to drink himself nearly blind. Even ones who rely on their brains to keep an entire city alive. Especially ones who rely on their brains to keep an entire city alive. Jesus, how does someone break their hand picking tava beans? Rodney ponders that, imagining more and more ridiculous scenarios. He remembers John in the cast and sling after M5W981, the way his fingers were swollen protruding from the white plaster. How his face was yellow and gaunt from the pain he refused to take opiates for. So, when are you gonna bring up going to the shrink? At first, Rodney thinks John's talking to his email. It takes a few seconds of long silence for him to realize this is a conversational salvo. Rodney clears his throat. "I wasn't, actually." "Huh." John is silent long enough for Rodney to dismiss the conversation. "You're not worried about my state of mental health?" It's John, so Rodney doesn't remember to filter. "You've never been the poster child for mental hygiene, but you haven't started shooting at the wrong side yet, so..." "I've just got some things on my mind." John pushes his chair away from the workstation he's borrowing and unfolds to his feet. "As I am well aware," Rodney doesn't look up at him. He doesn't want to have this conversation just as much as John doesn't. Rodney doesn't want to make eye contact and take this into SmackDown Atlantis, because they always fight worse when they're looking in each other's eyes. "You don't really know as much as you think, Rodney." John strides out as Rodney replays the conversation in his head. "Huh. He has no idea what that was about." "There was once a large Latantan. This is like what your people call a badger? That lived deep in the ground. Once a year it would roll on its side and great cataclysms would rock the ground, felling trees and overturning dwellings in the villages," Taylor Morgan explains in her calm tones. "Is this a metaphor, or do your people believe this to be a literal occurrence?" Dr. Jackson interjects, excitement clear in his voice. "Do your people truly believe your planet is carried on the back of a great turtle or a giant fish?" The Genii, as usual, attack without warning. Rodney's in the gate room, eating a peanut butter granola bar and pondering whether Americans are more like the Ori than would make most of the SGC comfortable if you brought that up, when the gate begins to dial in. "Off-world activation," Philip says, like that needs to be pointed out. "Dr. Jackson's IDC." Rodney hits his comm, instinct telling him this isn't good. He doesn't believe in prescience being supernatural. There is no supernatural. He knows something's wrong because something is always wrong. And Jackson always stays overnight when he goes off-world, but he's only been gone for a few hours. "Shepard, gate room, now." He knows Taylor and Ronan will come without being specifically named, knows Lorne and Zelenka will come from whatever part of Atlantis they're in at full speed. They have protocols, and one of them is this. When Dr. McKay calls Shepard, everyone come running. The gate whooshes fully to life, and a paleoanthropologist flies through like he's been hurled through. Two more fling themselves to the ground just on the inside of the gate, bullets whizzing in and wing the Marines who lined up at the base of the gate ramp with their guns drawn. Shepard drops to his knee with his P90 sighted just as Dr. Jackson backs through the gate, returning fire. The gate closes and the shield goes up. The paleoanthropology team groans like bleeding livestock, covered in mud and blood and contusions. Carson breaks through the ring of Marines with a med team trailing behind him. Dr. Jackson turns to face the room. His glasses are askew and he's got a scarf around his head, no vest, dirt from one end of him to the other, Well, that was familiar. He pops the safety on his gun and holds it like one of the soldiers. You all right, Doc? Shepard mimics Jackson's gun safety and stands. The Janai just bombed the site I was excavating, so I'm going to go with a no on that one. He strides away from the gate, slapping dust off his chest and pants. Rodney watches from the computer bank on the catwalk as Dr. Jackson waves his hand in John's direction. He's got blood on the side of his face. Carson and his team get the other anthropologists onto gurneys. The Marines stand down and help lift and wheel the wounded. Jackson says something to John, and John nods curtly. He hits his comm and whispers in Rodney's ear, "We're on. T-minus 15 in the glory room." "So have you heard the one about the brass's new meeting room?" Dr. Al-Hadi says, completely deadpan. "I was about to bring that up myself," guest host Dr. Simpson replies. "You do have the insider track there, and I'm sure you get hazard pay for that. Better than teaching off-world teams what the event horizon is over and over. My insider information is that it was named by an Athosian." Dr. Simpson sips on something and makes a clicking in the back of her throat. "I'm dubious." Ronan's theme song cues up softly behind them. "You're not the only one," Dr. Simpson scoffs. The Glory Room is sort of an ancient solarium, a room made of glass and titanium that juts over the water. Even the floor is crystal clear. The room freaks Rodney out. He feels unstable walking on glass, on air. They've been using the room against Rodney's protestations as a meeting locale since Elizabeth. Her office is off-limits. He can see through the glass walls from the control room, though, that someone's been watering her plants, that nothing's out of place. Jackson's got a butterfly bandage over his right eye, and it looks like his glasses have been trod on by a rhinoceros. The scowl on his face reminds Rodney that he's not just some sissy soft scientist. He's Daniel Jackson. Rodney's read the reports. He knows what the guy is capable of. In theory. Rodney's withholding final judgment as to whether he is D.I., dithering idiot, after all. Light catches the waves rolling 100 feet below them and sends ripples of bright white through the room that are broken into prisms against stubbly cheeks and scarred arms, tailless smooth hair overlaid with a visible spectrum diffused, and the red in Ronan's beard bright like rusted colored crayon. John's on edge more than usual. The light plays over him, tightening and loosening his jaw, grinding his teeth. The muscles in his neck stand out, and he keeps rolling his head on his shoulders to loosen them. He taps out Morse code messages and aborts them halfway through, probably aware that there's a good chance Jackson can read that simple code. "Aside from other reasons, we need to take care of the Janai situation immediately. I can't have them destroying sites that might be integral to finding the key to stopping the Ori." Jackson pulls the rag off his head and drops it into his lap before raking his hand through his hair. "What do you propose? Because it's not like we haven't been trying here." John's angry enough to let some of it show, and that could go either way in the apocalypse stakes. His eyes are dark, no green at all, brown and gold, and he hasn't shaved in a while. The Janai have proven to be untrustworthy negotiators. Taylor inclines her head to the table. How untrustworthy doesn't need to be said. "We blew up their home base, and it just led to footholds in other worlds. They're like butterflies," Ronan says. I think you mean cockroaches," Rodney replies, tapping the table. Ronan attempts to eviscerate him with a look. Anyway, it's clear everything we've tried has failed because, hello, abject failure here. We need a new plan or we could just give up. What could the Janai really accomplish with ancient technology and space traveling capabilities anyway?" Jackson looks at him with his mouth open for a second, and Rodney remembers they don't know each other at all. Rodney's sarcasm is being taken at face value, as though Rodney really thinks the Jedi couldn't blow up half the universe with Atlantis' knowledge. He opens his mouth to let out a stream of invective about Jackson's mental prowess when John cuts him off. Rodney's sarcastic fatalism aside, he's right. We need a new plan. "Killing them wholesale probably won't work. They're too scattered. Jackson says that, like, genocide would be a completely viable plan if they would just all stand close enough and hop in the ovens for Atlantis' convenience." This makes Rodney reassess Jackson as maybe closer to John's mentality than a glancing acquaintance indicated. "We can try to take Koya and Cowan both and cut the heads off the snakes," Ronan mumbles. Light catches a bead in his hair and almost blinds Rodney. Two more rattle together loudly as Ronan turns his head fast when a whale crests the water beneath them, water jetting up to blast under their feet. "They have snakes in Pegasus? I've never seen one," John says, with the same tone of voice he uses to discuss lima beans and rodents. "Ah, I think," Rodney snaps his fingers, "I think I might have an idea." Dr. Jamie Corrigan gives the usual Battlestar Galactica rundown from the infirmary. I think we can all agree that the re-envisioning of Starbuck hits a lot of buttons, but I wonder how much of this is because we have such a high population of female service people here in Atlantis, and that impacts all of our collective viewing of the program. The soft sounds of bedding rustling and shoes scraping on the ground. I don't know. Would you say that the Atlantis society is skewed from the larger picture of post-feminist, post-industrial that most of the Atlantis expedition came from? Dr. Jackson replies, earnest, engaged. I would say that we have a few more women in positions of authority and power than I am aware of existing anywhere outside of Atlantis or television, Dr. Corrigan responds good-naturedly. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you are a paleoanthropologist, correct? Dr. Jackson laughs, and other voices laugh along with him, including mumbled aye to that, and Starbuck rules in the background. Rodney eats a meal that could be lunch or could be dinner, his elbow propped on the surface of the smooth table in the mess. He eats leaves dressed with oil and vinegar and some woody spice. He eats something like saffron and couscous, with large pieces of a red vegetable studded through it. Rodney eats and thinks about how righteous he was when he went to work at Area 51, crowing to anyone that would listen that he'd never use his mind to build weapons. Well, everybody changes. Life is change. Without change, you're dead. Strictly speaking, the ancients built the devices. Rodney is just figuring out how to employ them as weapons. Oh, happy day. He takes a side trip to his room for a quick nap. He sleeps for 12 hours, face down on his bed, arms straight by his sides, his shoes still on. Rodney dreams of a black void, not space, not nothing, the absence of anything. All that exists is Rodney's terror of this absence, forever and ever and infinity. When he wakes up, John is standing in his doorway with the expression Rodney recognizes as the advent of death. Stackhouse and Pinsky's teams were hit off-world. Four dead, every damn one of them wounded. Where's McKay? Dr. Zelenka says in a clipped, rushed voice. In bed, Lieutenant Colonel Shepard replies. There's a long pause that could be artificially inserted. Well then, Dr. Zelenka says, and the sounds of his clothes rustling and datapad clicking against something are loud near the mic. What? Lieutenant Shepard says in an annoyed tone. He's exhausted. Jackson is quick. Rodney will grant him that. So, what you're saying is that this device will blind and deafen anyone within a certain blast radius? Daniel points at Rodney's device, doesn't touch the glowing lights or brush a hand over the flat surfaces. Nighttime in the glory room is like living inside of an illuminated oyster shell. The room glows in opalescence, shining on the water below and reflecting back up through the glass in rolling shimmers. Blue and green flash across their faces through the white glow all around them. That's exactly what I'm saying. Rodney smirks and crosses his arms across his chest. First problem, how do we avoid getting hit by the exact effects we're trying to inflict on the enemy? John leans over the device, and it clicks faster and glows brighter. Rodney glares at him. It gets annoying how technology I painstakingly work on until my fingers fall off and brain reverbs acts like your personal Furby. He sniffs. He's still tired, even after sleeping half a day away. He feels like that was worse than not sleeping, maybe. Furby? Ronan raises his eyebrows. Rodney, how do we stay unblind and not deafened? John steps away from the device, and Rodney imagines he hears it sigh in betrayal. Because it will be calibrated to specific settings, and the tactical teams will be equipped with sonic dampeners and UV blockers. Rodney shuts the machine off altogether. Earplugs and sunglasses? Jackson says with laughter in his voice. Oh, this is a great plan, John throws his hands in the air. I don't see you coming up with a better one. Rodney points at him and feels his blood pressure go up. He gets lightheaded and instantly irate. Really? How about we bomb the hell out of all of their installations, round up the survivors and shoot them, followed by a round of earth salting, John replies in his defensive, angry sing-song. Let's call that Plan B, Jackson says in a tone that Rodney can't read. No, really, I like tava beans, Dr. Parrish says, especially dried, like edamame, you know? You're just stoned, someone mumbles, too indistinct and muffled to place, the whir of the humidity machines in the botany lab shushing and clicking. Laughter erupts in a cascade, several voices race together and spinning around in a choir of jubilation. John comes by the lab while Rodney's tinkering with Zelenka's scores on NHL Center Ice. He slouches over to the big bomb thing and waves his hand at it. Blue and yellow lights blink on and begin flickering in what appears to be a random pattern. John's going almost completely gray at his temples, and he's got a lock of almost solid white growing in the front. Rodney hasn't seen him in bright light like this in a while. All of their missions take place on overcast planets, and all of their briefings are too heated for Rodney to pay attention to the little physical details. Radek's gonna bust you for that. John leans his ass against the table the bomb's on and crosses his arms in front of him. Plausible deniability. Rodney rolls back Radek's scores in increments, 2 points here, 3 there. That's my line. Yours is critical mass. John's smiling when Rodney looks up again. Rodney almost feels like, what is it? What's going on here? Oh, right. John's playing him. What do you want? Rodney sits up straight and thinks of his jello rations that John is so cavalier about giving away. Why are you so suspicious? Maybe I'm just glad to see you. John shifts and cocks his hip out a little. Don't insult my intelligence. You're clearly up to something. Hiding from Taylor and need me to stash you? Rodney feels his eyebrows go up and leans forward, ready for John to tell him how he's managed to piss Taylor off this time. No, Rodney, I haven't barged in on a tea party or knocked over a ritual haystack. He waves his hands over the top of the bomb again, and it bleeps. Show me how to use this. Oh, that. Rodney stores Radek's amended hockey scores. I'm going to give you the rundown on that T-minus 3 hours before the missions begin, so you don't forget if I get hit in the head, or poisoned, or whatever new and unimaginative way the Janai have found to kill people. No, you're going to show me now. John is placid and glacial. Rodney looks up at him and knows immediately what's going on in John's hamster brain. Oh, no. You're not leaving me here with the women and children and Zelenka. Rodney pops out of his chair and waves his hand in John's face. You're not going, McKay. Do you know what the Jedi would give to get their fucking hands on you? He doesn't move and his voice barely modulates. You think I would tell them anything? Rodney screams, not even caring that Dumais and Porter on the other end of the room openly watching. I don't think you understand me here. John pulls himself to his full height and saunters right into Rodney's face. This is not negotiable, and you've got it all wrong. I know you'd rather die than give them anything. That's the whole point. With that, he lifts both eyebrows and wanders away, throwing an "I'll be back after supper" over his shoulder with a little flick of his fingers. Dr. Jackson rumbles in ancient, his voice and tone the same as in English, heavily emotive and inflected. Another, female voice answers him, stuttering slightly over some words, but semi-fluent and full of amusement. Dr. Jackson responds, and the word Starbuck is clear in his dialogue. In the next pass, the female voice clearly says Adama. Rodney avoids John during the lead-up to the Janai mission. He knows Radek, the traitor, showed John how to use the device. Jackson watches Rodney from behind his glasses with two sharp eyes and a way about him that's both judgmental and sympathetic at once. Rodney's intellect will still be superior to Jackson's even with a lobotomy, and he's had a lifetime supply of pity, thank you, so he avoids Jackson too. Everything sucks and he's miserable, and he's not entirely sure why. It's not like anything's gotten exponentially worse in the last week, but Rodney's moody, unhappy in a way that isn't about mourning, whether that be for Cinnabon Icing or Elizabeth. I still kick your ass even when you change scores. Radek sits down next to him and Rodney realizes he's been staring at the same data on his screen for the last 10 minutes. Rodney lifts his chin and crosses his arms over his chest, glaring at Radek. I'm sure I have no idea what goulash-tainted crackpot idea you've concocted, but I don't have to resort to such tactics to beat you at hockey, Rodney sniffs. That's what Canadians say at World Cup, too, Radek grins. Stupid international rinks, if you played it the right way... Rodney trails off as Radek boots up the game. Do you think there's any of that barky cocoa left? Colonel Shepard is only frightened. He does not mean to undermine you or your contribution, Rodney. You should not take this as personal insult, Radek murmurs as he and Jaeger Deeks are on Koivu. Rodney hunches down himself, shoulders coming down. He's an ass. Radek tries to score, and it goes wide. He would not survive your loss, maybe. Maybe you work that into the equation before you assume results. Rodney scores. He tosses his arms in the air and shouts, "In your face, little Czech weasel! In your face!" So graceful in victory, Rodney. You're an example to us all. Radek rubs his eyes. The podcast is suspended until after the Janai mission. Rodney kneels by the device and checks and rechecks the calibrations on his data pad. You gonna wish me good luck, Rodney? He looks up and John's standing over him with his hand on his gun, smiling in a way that's not really a smile at all, just a defensive maneuver, like a somersault away from shrapnel. Go fuck yourself. Rodney isn't feeling particularly charitable today. He should be supervising the device. That is his job, and Don can take his overprotective troglodyte instincts and ram them so far up his ass his mouth tastes like caveman. Alrighty then. The fake smile deepens and John swings away, falsely casual. Rodney watches with his arms crossed over his chest and head tilted back from behind the computer bank as the tactical teams deploy. Cadman's been promoted and is leading her own team. Orin is leading his team through the gate instead of standing as leader of the city defenses because John is not taking his team. John is traveling with the bomb. Ronan steps up next to Rodney as Lauren steps through the gate. His posture mirrors Rodney's. I don't like this plan. Which part? That we're not killing everyone and wearing their skins as clothes? The words are harsher than the delivery, and Ronan smiles. The part where Shepard's going through the gate and we're guarding the metal and glass. There's real bitterness there, and Rodney looks closer at Ronan. He has a black eye and scratches on one cheek. Since Rodney didn't see him get that off-world, it must have been training the civilians. Rodney wonders which of the scientists, or social scientists, is good enough to get one in on Ronan. Atlantis is unique. We have to protect the city. Rodney doesn't mean at all that Ronan and he should be standing here watching John wave teams through, as the gate is dialed and redialed. He means in the general way, and he doesn't even know why he says that anyway, because he's probably more angry than Ronan is. The knowledge here is nothing without the people who use it. It's the people who matter more. Rodney watches John step through the gate behind the FRED. Rodney knows that when Ronan says people, he means three people, and his anger with John diminishes slightly from supernova to nova. This is his way of dealing with Elizabeth? The inflection is almost a question because Rodney just realizes it when he glances down and sees Taylor staring at the gate from behind Marine, her arms crossed across her chest and her chin in the air, an expression of grave displeasure on her face. Ronnie's face goes slack and his mouth opens, his arms drop to his sides. Ronan looks down on him with a slight smile. I lived on my own for 7 years, McKay, but your people skills are worse than mine. Rodney sputters. People skills? Who taught you that? Radic laughs behind Rodney's back. Fitting. Rodney rolls around. That's enough from you, traitor. Let me see that data. He snaps his fingers and gets lost in the numbers. The first team comes back to the gate in less than 10 minutes. They're wearing blackout sunglasses, similar to the ones worn to view solar eclipses, and industrial earplugs, and dragging captives. Several Marines break the half-circle in front of the gate and move in to secure the prisoners. Ronan and Taylor triple and quadruple-check the Janai, who are zip-strapped at ankle and wrist. The Marines carry them to the makeshift prison on Pier P, for prison, and that reminds Rodney of Ford, but he tries not to think about that after the initial amusement. Wait. Something occurs to Rodney as the second team gates in. Where's Jackson? He looks around the room and doesn't see him. Rodney scales when Radic throws up his hands and shrugs. He's the boss, as Azalika says as he turns back to his console, white letters reflecting off his glasses. That's just great. Rodney's anger zips back to Supernova. A guy who wears bandanas on his head unironically gets to go, but I'm stuck here with the retreads? Shepard's dead. On a scale of you'll regret that comment, Rodney figures that statement is probably about a 7, when John is dragged back through the gate by a Marine, followed by another Marine dragging a Janai. Rodney's world constricts to battle mode, and he takes the stairs 3 at a time and kneels beside John in what feels like 4 steps. He assesses rapidly and sees that John has at least 2 GSWs, one on his left shoulder and the other somewhere in his torso. There's clotted blood spatter on his face, and he's unconscious. Where the fuck is Carson? Rodney thinks he projects in a calm tone, even though when he replays it later in his mind, he'll realize it was a strangled scream. Rodney applies pressure to the wound on John's torso and shoulder. It seems like an eternity before Carson's there, calmly rocking John on his side and rolling him onto a gurney without trying to dislodge Rodney. Rodney springs to his feet as the gurney rises. This isn't happening. This isn't happening. This isn't happening, Rodney whispers. He runs next to John, Carson's steady voice barking orders to his subordinates and calling out medical mumbo-jumbo. Rodney blinks and sees blood congealing in clumps in John's hair, blinks again and sees arterial spray on the side of his face caught in his stubble, blinks again and understands. understands why John didn't want to be the one aware in this moment, the one left behind. Carson peels Rodney's hands off John's body as they prep him for surgery, but he does not stop him from stripping and scrubbing up to come into the surgery. Rodney bathes himself in betadine and swallows himself in lintless fabric and plastic and paper and waddles in behind Lieutenant Gonzalez, the nurse who stepped Rodney up when he fell out of his chair in the lab dead asleep and cut his head. Rodney stands in the back of the room and listens to the babbling, the medical talk, smells the blood and antiseptic. He's not scared, he's not fretful, he's numb. He feels nothing. One of the bodies detaches from the cluster around John and walks over to him. "Come on," a soft female voice urges him. He follows as she leads him to stand at John's head. "Don't docile him, but you can put your hand on his face or head if you want." He takes his hand and places it on John's forehead. He realizes this must be Dr. Chin, the anesthesiologist. Rodney stands there with his hand on John's head for a long time. He doesn't know how long. At one point, Dr. Chin places her tiny hand on the small of Rodney's back and says, "It's going to be all right." But that's before John dies on the table and they have to revive him. The first time they had to revive him. The second time is the nick in his aorta. The first time is something else Rodney doesn't hear. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row that mark our place. And in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly scarce heard amid the guns below, Dr. Jackson reads, slow and with the sort of gravity that speaks to insight about death and loss. Rodney sits by John's bed. Sometimes he plays Tetris on his datapad. Sometimes he listens to Taylor sing to John a thousand songs of healing that he would normally mock mercilessly, but now he understands the ritual of it, the cursing the darkness sort of struggle with uselessness and futility that it demonstrates. Sometimes Ronan tells stories about fallen comrades in an upbeat way that Rodney doesn't understand. Jackson debriefs him with a soft expression on his face. 7 dead, 11 more wounded, 3 critically, not counting Shepard. Town is being held for questioning. "Call ya?" Rodney asks, looking up from the assault by the useless squares floating down from the top of his screen. Jackson just stares back at him. "You mean no one told you?" Rodney stares up at him. No one has said much of anything to Rodney besides, "You should sleep, and I brought you my jello." Colonel Shepard killed him. Jackson takes off his glasses and rubs his eyes. It's probably what I would have done in his place, too, all things considered. Jackson shrugs. Rodney doesn't care what Jackson would have done. He doesn't want this man standing here at all. If he could think Jackson out of existence right now, well, the obvious. Rodney hasn't thought much about how John got hurt. Thinking about that leads to thinking about John being hurt, which leads to this whole not waking up thing. Rodney is doing a bang-up job of not thinking at all, which is quite a feat for him, and he thanked Jackson, clearly D.I., to get the hell out of here and leave Rodney to his Tetris and Terry Pratchett. The thing is that Rodney's not really talking all that much now. He sticks to single words and monosyllables to keep everything inside his mouth. He's afraid of what will cascade out if he starts to really talk. Words will connect to words, and he'll start thinking again. I know the senior staff don't talk to the psych people around here. Hell, it's an SGC tradition, so you know, if you want to, you know. Jackson takes his glasses off again and rubs his eyes. Anyway, I've been there, probably more than anyone else you'll meet. So, if you do. With that eloquent speech, Jackson slithers away like a half-squashed bug. Make him buy you, the whisper cuts off into a cough, dinner first. Rodney pops out of his chair and leans over John. He gets an up-tilt of John's lips and half-open eyes. John coughs again. Rodney reaches for the water at the bedside and angles the straw. He does not call Carson. He would ruin it all. Rodney wants a few seconds before the voodoo rituals start and the people swarm in and kick Rodney out. "You died," Rodney says. "You died twice." Thinking is still not back online. John's almost smile dips. His hand raises from the bed a little. "Rodney." And before he can say anything else, the alarm goes off with the Colonel Shepard's awake and the stampede is on. Rodney gets shoved out of the way and he goes, but just to the periphery to watch as they flash lights in John's eyes and stab him and press tools to his skin. Carson lets Rodney back into his place at the bedside after a while. Rodney has no sense of time anymore. He has very little sense anymore, really. Here, look, sit yourself down then, and... Carson reaches into his pocket and pulls out a sucker. Here, have a lolly. Wait, are you giving me candy? Like... Rodney sputters. Carson, I'm not 10 years old at the bedside of a dying parent here. John sort of laughs. Where's mine? He rasps out. Rodney takes the sucker anyway. It's cherry. Anyone would have taken it. Blood drive? Dr. McKay says with a sort of vehemence that scatters the science staff like balls on a pool table. Doesn't everyone already donate blood on a regular basis? Wait, was that a trick to get me to donate blood? What are you up to, you mad geneticist? Is this a cloning project? Have you completely lost your mind, finally, and you're trying to clone me? I can understand, in principle, why you picked me, but do you think we could harvest the organs? I might be handy, really, if I ever had organ failure or some kind of... We're just out of O-positive blood, Rodney. Sheesh, Lieutenant Colonel Shepard cuts him off. I thought everyone involved in the Stargate program had type A blood, Dr. Jackson muses. Carson releases John from the infirmary with a whole list of admonitions that Rodney doesn't listen to. John's barely moving, so it's not like he's really going for a marathon. Ronan flutters around, trying to look casual, as John and Rodney walk at an enfeebled pace to Rodney's lab. Don't you have something better to do, like skin things and wear them on your head? Rodney glares at Ronan like he can make him go away if he thinks it hard enough. He hasn't had a second alone with John since the mission, since days before the mission, because he was avoiding him before that, and oh, how many ways has he managed to regret that? You could just ask me to go away so you can be alone. Ronan smirks and looks down at Rodney with a saucy head tilt. Rodney really wishes he had his dad in moments like this. Ronan, John sighs. Rodney looks at him in alarm, ready to catch him if he tilts over or scream into his comm for Carson if stitches burst or blood gushes from somewhere. Okay. Ronan just peels away from them and walks in the opposite direction. How did you do that? Rodney peeks around John to watch Ronan striding away, easy and loose and maybe even... whistling? He respects me, John says in his usual smug tone. Rodney glares at him and huffs. He's just your pet. Pets don't respect, they imprint. Are you jealous? John asks with a hint of laughter. Rodney lifts his chin and almost gives his standard denial, but he stops and loosens his posture. Looks over at John. The beard on his face and rings under his eyes. The way he holds his hand to the wound on his side and walks so slowly. Pain evident even through the painkillers he didn't refuse this time. Maybe, Rodney says. Maybe is a lie. Definitely is the truth. But he figures he has to start somewhere. The change has already happened. The real change. The stuff inside that's not made of atoms and spinning particles, but made of elusive concepts like attachment and belonging and fear. Maybe, John echoes with a smile. Rodney moves his hand to press it against the small of John's back, but drops it, remembering the surgery. Dr. Chin doing the same to Rodney. He doesn't want to make a gesture that could be mistaken for simply comforting. He's never been good at human interaction, and John makes everything worse in an infinite way by being so opaque. Even now, Rodney's not sure if he's even reading this right, if there is anything to read. You overthink brushing your teeth, don't you? John grabs Rodney's hand and sticks it on his own back. See? Your arm moves, your hand connects with something, in this case, me, and that's that. There are a boggling variety of toothpaste brands and toothbrushes available today, and one must stay informed so as to keep one's teeth at optimal... Can it, Rodney? John elbows him in the side softly and sort of slumps into him, keeping the contact as they progress down the hall. Rodney smiles triumphantly. Life is the river and not the river at the same time. Rodney's life might really be John Shepard and not John Shepard at the same time. Well, we've come to the end of yet another podcast, Nim. Any words of wisdom to impart? Dr. Golden sucks something through a straw. Live long and prosper, Dr. Al-Hadi replies with a throaty laugh. That's better than last week, as sands through the hourglass, these are the days of our lives. So, I'll take what I can get. The theme song from Katamari Damacy filters in behind her voice, the in-credit music of each podcast. This week, we'd like to thank Dr. Daniel Jackson for so gracefully accepting the water balloon ambush. We really didn't know they loaded them with KY, Dr. Al-Hadi cuts in. and we'd like to wish a speedy recovery to everyone's favorite flyboy, Colonel John Shepherd. Congratulations on the promotion, Dr. Al-Hadi cuts in again. From me, Sarah Golden, and me, Nima Al-Hadi, this has been the Atlantis Podcast. They finish together, as always. Part 4, Definition by Negation, Held Fast to Fly Free. John wakes up thinking, ouch. His second thought is, oh Christ, Elizabeth. And his third thought is, where's Rodney? Between the pain meds and what the pain meds are for, John's not feeling like himself. Not that he knows exactly what himself is, because it's not like he sits around deep in self-reflection about himself and other things like that. Man, it must be time for more medication, right? One of the stipulations for him leaving the infirmary was that he'd keep his comm open at night so Carson could baby monitor him to his weirdo doctorly content. John picks up his headset off the pillow and whispers, not dead yet, and sits up. His stitches pull and he's maybe a little dehydrated and he's definitely feeling like shit. He would moan and whine to himself, but then half the medical staff of Atlantis would come running into his quarters, full tilt to gurney him off for another round of prodding and semi-solid foods. John hates hospitals, hates being infirm and everyone around him focused on his infirmity, but more than that, Atlantis needs Rodney doing things with his brain, making things work and keeping them all from blowing themselves up. And if John lands back in medbay, Rodney's gonna just sit his ass right there on John's side of the sliding curtain and stare like that puppet from Labyrinth. No one needs that. For one, it makes everything so obvious, and John doesn't like people in his business. Rodney and him, that's John's business, and he doesn't need to feed the damn podcast any more fodder for the city to hee-haw and snicker at. John sort of weeble-wobbles to the bathroom, Atlantis ready with a solid wall, a basin, the shower tub thing, ready to catch him if he falls. He doesn't have far to go, so close to the ground already. Have you noticed a pronounced lack of meat in our diet lately? An Australian inflected voice asks. In the background, someone curses and screams. Do you not know a base from an alkaloid? No, I live off Jell-O and Athosian berries. After that whole episode with the girl on the support staff at the Diwali party, wow, I'm just saying, better safe than sorry, a woman answers in a rush. Can you believe this catalyst? Fuck, it's going to eat through the table. John sits around for a while, fuzzy and muddled. He thinks about Cowan mysteriously not waking up the other morning and knows for a fact that was Major Lorne. He wonders if Jackson had the other prisoner stranded on the planet of the lemurs to keep Lorne from them, too. Getting his clothes on and off sucks. John realizes after he has to cut his shirt off that he might still need help with getting a new one on. He ponders calling Carson, but he doesn't want the babying and clucking. He considers calling Taylor, but she's just as bad, the mom to Carson's dad with her judging eyes, and perhaps you are not ready to leave the care of others yet, John. Ronan would totally help him out, but he might rip John's stitches or something manhandling him. Okay, so maybe Jackson? He seems like the kind of guy... What are you doing? Rodney stands in the doorway to John's bathroom with his hands on his hips and an expression he usually reserves for botanists and other life scientists on his face. This was the obvious answer all along, but John doesn't want to get in the habit of always calling Rodney, of expecting Rodney to just be there. John is sitting on what they call a toilet. It's really more like an egg-shaped jut from the wall. He's at least got his pants on and his t-shirt in his hand. At his feet are his infirmary-issued scrub-like pants and the wraparound shirt they gave him with the ties. Except the ties wouldn't come loose, so, in a fit of quick thinking, John had cut the shirt off with the fingernail scissors and the cabinet thing. John looks down at the little pieces of blue fabric, his bare feet, the warming glow of the heated floor of the bathroom, and he really has no explanation that doesn't cover the ground Rodney's already covered in his mind like the Tasmanian devil spinning around every variation that could have occurred. Couldn't get my shirt off. He's tired and doesn't really give a shit since it's just Rodney. Can't get this one on, either. He holds out his shirt and tries to smile winningly. You aren't this stupid. Rodney steps into the room and snatches the shirt away. You can't lift your arm over your head. You don't get to wear big boy clothes. He sneers at the mess on the floor. Come on. He hesitates, but wraps his arm around John's good side and takes most of John's weight. But what will I wear, Rodney? John hears the whine and doesn't even bother to suppress it. He hurts, and Rodney's a big sissy about pain, so John isn't going to be mortified that he's not being a big enough man about being shot twice at point-blank range. Except for when he is going to be mortified and manly, but that's not right now, with Rodney practically carrying him back to his bed and... Wait. What were you doing here to start? He winces as rodents try to eat themselves out of his shoulder. With... Oh, I don't know, just stopping by for a rousing game of Dance Dance Revolution? Rodney is gentle with him as he helps John sit on the bed. I was making sure you took your medication, because who knows what kind of manly pride thing you've got going. John squeezes the hand Rodney has wrapped around his good side really hard as another wave of pain hits, probably jarred by Rodney's enthusiastic complaining. Rodney doesn't flinch or try to pull his hand away. I think of snow when I'm in pain. The way snow looks in the moonlight, you know? How the light refracts and reflects and it sparkles and twinkles. John listens to Rodney ramble on about snow and ice, and the pain fades before he remembers he was hurting pretty badly there. This shine on my hair comes from Vishan roots, Taylor Moggin says out of nowhere. Do you use it as a conditioner or what? Major Cadman interjects. She's breathing hard. I am unsure of what you mean by conditioner. Conditioning means to make terms, does it not? Wood clicks on wood, and a loud whooshing sounds. Major Cadman groans and pants. I mean, do you put it on your hair and rinse it out, or do you slap it on and leave it on there until the next time you wash your hair? Ah, I know now. Taylor pauses as more scuffling transpires. There is a paste you can make, and this paste allows manipulation of hair. Such as Colonel Shepherd's. He uses this paste. Is that what you would like me to tell you of? Then, a loud smack like a body hitting the floor. Ronan sets his food tray down on the table across from John while Rodney fusses over both of their meals. Rodney's unnaturally solicitous of the food service people, but maybe if John could die from ingesting, say, milk, he'd feel the same way about that situation as Rodney does. So, Ronan says, cutting an apple-like fruit. Promotion? He lifts an eyebrow. John doesn't really want to talk about that. He thinks it's stupid. His commendation was about stopping the war, but everyone on Atlantis knows it was all about revenge. What the idiots back at SGC think about John's professional performance really has no bearing on his life, other than being glad they haven't tried to permanently relieve him of duty, which is a scenario he has contingency plans for anyway. Yeah, John resettles himself a little bit, looking over Ronan's shoulder to watch Rodney's back shift under his jacket. Pointless, since you're already the highest-ranking officer. Ronan eats a slice of fruit. He's had his say on this matter, and it's finished. John appreciates that. He also completely agrees with the guy. Rodney questions the sergeant standing beside the table filled with fruit about each variety in depth. John watches him, but there's cordite in the back of John's mouth and burning skin in his nose, and his skin feels too thin to keep the blood inside. Yeah, I don't know. Comparing the Ori to the Catholic Church is a little harsh. The new pope looked like a prior, Dr. Meacham replies. Could you people focus here? We're looking for a, quote, glowy orb-like thing that clicks like Caldwell's arthritis, unquote. Sergeant Stackhouse cuts off the theological discussion. McKay could really work on specificity. A color or size might be helpful? Dr. Jackson sighs. Wait, you don't know what we're looking for? Dr. Meacham sounds worried. No, Dr. Jackson replies sheepishly. I'm just tagging along. John can't just hang around all day reading War and Peace and getting in Rodney's way while he works. He sits in the gate room in an unofficial capacity in Rodney's button-down shirt, striped blue and yellow, the Humanity, and supervises as Lorne gets ready to deploy his team through the gate. Don't pick up or touch anything. That means chicks, or whatever you're into, goats, ascended ancients, hell, ferns, but it also means objects. Don't reach out and grab anything that lights up or flashes or anything. You just stand there and look bored. It's easy. He pats his tack vest, a superstitious gesture made before stepping through the gate each time. Taylor smiles benignly at him and waves to the Ethosian girl at her side. It's a training mission for the girl to learn to negotiate off-world. She's a niece or a cousin or something of Taylor's. John trusts Lorne, so Lorne gets to watch Taylor's back. Not that she probably needs it, but John's maybe a little overly cautious these days. It's better to err on the side of alive. Engaging dialing sequence. John doesn't listen to the rest of the computer crap. He watches the symbols rotate and listens to Atlantis hum around him. Jackson appears at his elbow with a cup of coffee and some dusty old scrolls. I'm familiar with this sort of off-duty refusal to take recuperation lying down. He smiles down at John, and John reflexively smiles back, but he's not happy or amused. Jackson's weird. Not that John has a lot of normal in his life anymore. But there's weird like Cadman, who talks like one of the guys and has a better sniper rating than just about anyone in Atlantis, but who also speaks ancient and made a perfect score on the SAT. John's read everyone's file. Then there's Jackson, who is just weird. You look better. Not so jaundiced. That's good. Okay, well, you've got everything under control here, so I'm going to join the team exploring the library complex. He waves and walks away. Huh, John says, and when he swivels his chair back, Rodney's standing on the other side of him with his sour expression of annoyance increased by a coefficient of 3. What a geek, Rodney says, and even though John agrees 123%, he's got a role here. Don't be mean, Rodney. I'm sure you can win 2 out of 3 at Balderdash. Oh, ha, ha. That joke would have been funnier if you said Sudoku, since Jackson probably does know all the definitions of the words in Balderdash, because he's a geek. Rodney makes a strangled whine, and John doesn't have to look over his shoulder to know that Jackson's standing right there. The funny thing is, that game has all these technical and patented terms that I've never heard of. I really love that game, actually. No one will ever play with me, though, because of the whole geek thing. Jackson laughs. John thinks he might like the guy after all, even if he is weird. What a geek, Dr. McKay says with venom. Don't be mean, Rodney. I'm sure you can win 2 out of 3 at Balderdash. Colonel Shepard replies in his usual dry tone. Fingers snap. Oh, ha, ha. That joke would have been funnier if you said Sudoku, since Jackson probably does know all the definitions of the words in Balderdash, because he's a geek. Dr. McKay stops suddenly and makes a high-pitched noise. The funny thing is, that game has all these technical and patented terms that I've never heard of. I really love that game, actually. No one will ever play with me, though, because of the whole geek thing. Dr. Jackson cuts in, sounding thoughtful and amused at the same time. Who wants to play Balderdash with Dr. Jackson? Dr. Al-Hadi whispers into the ears of Atlantis. I know I do. You have got to be kidding me. John sits on one of the ass-molding chairs in the lab where Rodney's built something like a super collider out of ancient paperclips and rubber bands. Rodney's on his knees with his face close to a pull-out panel of crystals. John's watching his back move under his thin shirt, the wings of his shoulder blades lifting and falling as he pulls out crystals and replaces them with others that look exactly the same to John. In this moment, John's really sick of being sick. He's lonely, even with Rodney sitting right there, and he's felt this way for a long time, felt it before about other people who he never had and never tried to have for obvious reasons. But Rodney's right there, and he's Rodney. John feels like he's already in a relationship with the guy, passive aggression and unspoken landmines, and Rodney's unreachable expectations cluttering up John's neat, carefully compartmentalized life. If he has to listen to Rodney explain his dissertation and its evolution in step-by-step, play-by-play, and wake up to him standing over his bed with medication and a bottle of orange juice wrapped in 500 hand towels, shouldn't he be able to reach out and touch the tips of Rodney's eyelashes and feel the weight of Rodney pressing him down, 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 anchoring him to earth? John thinks that the freedom of flight is only truly spectacular when it's contrasted by being held firmly to the earth by something just as important as the wide blue stretching out beneath him and G's tossing his soul free. John realizes Rodney's silent. What? Never mind, I'll keep my brilliance to myself. This is exactly the sort of shit John shouldn't have to put up with if Rodney doesn't also come with orgasms. You were complaining about the Balderdash tournament. John's winging it here. No. If you hadn't tuned out imagining nubile young Athosian girls dancing topless, or whatever other unoriginal fantasy you were exploring, then you would have been privy to my genius plan to ditch this burg and be out of town when all that ridiculous Jackson feasting transpires. They're eating Jackson? John says in his most clueless voice. Rodney makes a scoffing noise. Nice try. You're not that stupid, because if you were, I wouldn't like you. You like me, huh? John can't help himself. Rodney's virtue is really only still intact because John died twice. Oh, for the love of... You were utterly ridiculous. Also, oddly needy. Fuck off, McKay. The sad part is that Rodney's right. John knows most of the worst stuff is kept at bay by the consistent drug haze he's in. He's not at his nadir yet, not by a long shot, and he's really hoping Rodney doesn't hold out on him until that abyss yawns, because then John's not going to be in any kind of shape to make it easy on the guy. Balderdash is tool of English-speaking oppression, Dr. Zelika says morosely. I speak 5 languages, but I could not win this game. I live in a village full of idiots. I am the village genius. Dr. McKay retorts with a loud scoff. Dr. Golden's laughter spirals into everyone's ears. I wonder if we could rig it so they play each other. John's dreams reach out for him and hold him down in spirals of purple, black, and blue-red. He hears screaming in the distance, a constant, sustained wail, and he's been trying for nights and nights, for a decade's worth of nights, to get there, to stop the screaming, to save the screamer. He never gets there. He's trapped in Kabul, in Oman, in Antarctica, on a nameless planet in the Pegasus Galaxy. He falls from the sky, his ejection seat jammed. He picks up his gun and realizes his magazine's empty. He gets caught in a sudden updraft and his propeller craps out. He reaches for Elizabeth and she falls apart like ash. Dr. McKay laughs uproariously to himself and launches into song.
I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers.
This song is obnoxious, Rodney, Dr. Zelika murmurs. Why do all North Americans respect pirates? A broken choir breaks out on...
The Antelope sloop was a sickening sight.
How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now.
She'd a list to the port and her sails in rags, and the cook in the scuppers with the staggers and jags.
God damn them all.
Dr. Zelinka sighs heavily as a good portion of Atlantis sings along with the math and physics team. When John was in college, he was in love with a boy named Brandon. He didn't know he was in love because he'd never been in love before. Sometimes, John wishes his life had progressed without finding out, never being in love. Love stains John's life like Kool-Aid on a white shirt. Love makes people act like assholes or like children or just heedless of anything else. John loved Brendan with daggers and pain that destroyed a very close friendship. John never said anything, never made a move because he wouldn't have known what to do anyway. He never learned on TV or in movies how to say to another man, I want to touch your hair, or you're beautiful, more beautiful than breathing. John didn't learn how to say those things before Brandon died in a car accident. Drunk driver, old story, everyone's got one. Worse, John didn't learn any real lessons from that. He learned only that love was hurting, and in the end, everyone leaves. Or maybe they leave before the end. Sometimes people leave in the beginning or in the middle. He already knew people were disappointing, thanks, Dad, and that people were unpredictable. Thanks, Mom. He could have learned that love was pain from bad rock lyrics, so he always thought that the death was extraneous. Thanks, Universe. There are many ways to lose someone. Death is just the most dramatic. Sadly, it's a drama John's been scripted into for a lot of years. John knew he was in love with Rodney way before Elizabeth died. He takes it personally that his life story has to include the motif love equals death, because John loved Elizabeth too, for her optimism in the face of insurmountable odds, for her affection for pomegranates and lemon zinger tea, for her proximity to the most important event in John's entire life. He knows that he's not the most stable guy on any planet in two galaxies, and that other people think his actions are often rash, but the fact of the matter is that if someone has to go again, John's not going to be the guy left alive thinking, what if? He's not doing that again, and if it means being the one who dies, so be it. The truth is, he'd much rather taste Rodney's exhaled breath and rub his face against the skin on his neck, but the breaks is the breaks, and John's not sure either one of them will ever be ready to shit or get off the pot. So what I want to stress the most is that when you see this specific warning in Ancient, which by now I expect you all to recognize, if not actually read, turn around and walk the other way. Don't open the door or cabinet or turn on the machine. But what was I talking about? Oh yes, the Balderdash tournament will happen in rounds, with eliminations happening at the end of each full game. Seating will be random. I think Dr. Zelenka formulated an algorithm. Okay, so Rodney was serious about avoiding the stupid Balderdash thing. I can't travel off-world. I'm not cleared for duty. John stares up at Rodney fluttering around the room. He's got his data pad in one hand and a fruit roll-up or something in the other. Excuse me, did I say anything about you? Rodney stops pacing and glares at him. You don't have to worry about your narrow defeat at the hands of an uber-geek being proclaimed all over the city for the rest of your life. People will get something new to make fun of you for next week, Rodney. Come on. John almost lets the smile show when Rodney tries to fold his arms over his chest, but is prevented by the stuff in his hands. Oh, ha, ha, ha. John notices then that Rodney's really upset. This isn't the usual Chicken Little routine, but something bigger. John gives that 2 seconds to percolate as Rodney picks his pacing back up, rattling on about the inhumanity of it all. Right. Rodney must care what people think. That didn't ever really occur to John, because it's Rodney, and since when does he give a shit what anyone thinks? You could beat him. John tries this strategy first. Rally the troops. Rodney waves his data pad over his head and chomps on his fruit roll-up. There's always that possibility, but it's outweighed by the facts in this scenario, which are, and I can't believe I'm saying this, that Jackson knows more than me. About something totally asinine, and what was I thinking applying myself to the fundamentals of reality when I could have been studying something so applicable to our busy lives in this day and age as slaves and concubines such as hieroglyphics? Perhaps I could free us from the Egyptian slave masters with my staggering knowledge of how to read. John gives in and laughs at that one. Why don't you just pretend to have some kind of thermonuclear meltdown in the lab or something? Strategy 2. Agreeing to play by Rodney's rules and working within that framework. Thought of that is too suspicious. He finishes his snack and stuffs the wrapper in his pocket. John wonders if Rodney's propensity to not litter comes from being Canadian or if it's some complex theory Rodney has about... Rodney? John plasters on the most pathetic expression he can manage. Rodney stops and turns when he hears John's tone. Are you all right? What's wrong? Did you pull something? John knows that he's a bad, bad man, that he gets a huge boost of self-satisfaction because Rodney is this worried about him, that Rodney will drop his hysterics over a mortal round of intellectual embarrassment and come running if John so much as sneezes too hard. Rodney bends over him and drops his data pad on the bed and flutters his hands around like he wants to pat John all over to make sure he's intact, but is holding himself back. Holding himself back. It's because of the injuries, but fuck it, man. John's over this. Rodney tilts his head down, and John tilts his up. And just like that, John brushes his mouth against the side of Rodney's face. His stubble is fine, almost soft, even with as short as it is. Rodney makes a clicking kind of noise and freezes. John hooks two fingers of his good hand into Rodney's collar and holds him still. He moves just enough that Rodney's startled breaths coming out of his mouth fall right on John's lips. Cherry fruit roll-up. Oh, Rodney says. Now? And he flicks out his tongue to touch John's bottom lip. Rodney's careful, so careful, and John remembers he works with equipment that can kill you day in and day out, not unlike a soldier in that way. He presses his hands palm down on the bed on either side of John's legs and slides down to his knees, pulling at John's mouth with his own and pulling John at a pivot so their positions are reversed, John leaning down to kiss Rodney, who leans up, on his knees. Rodney pivots John just like that, his mouth a fulcrum, and John is the unmovable object, after all, not Rodney, because Rodney lets him touch his face and his eyelashes, and John hides his face right in the side of Rodney's neck like he's wanted to for a very long time. Rodney lets him. I'm scared to hurt you. Rodney still doesn't pick his hands up off the bed. I'm scared I'll hurt you worse. John almost laughs at how impossible that really is. John only got shot in the first place because he was scared of the same thing. Major Lorne laughs with the sort of zeal everyone in Atlantis knows comes accompanied by his head tossed back and his hand on his chest. No shit. You really ended up in the middle of a sex ritual? It wasn't so much a ritual as a rite of passage. Jack's probably got 15 or so illegitimate children seated around the Milky Way, Dr. Jackson replies, clearly not fully sober. No shit. Who doesn't, though? The sound of liquid pouring, sandbagging. Can't have too many offspring, gotta keep up the bloodline. What amazes me about what you just said is how I don't think you're joking. Major Lorne laughs exactly like he did when the segment cut in. Zelenka has this way about him. John figures he's probably projecting, but the guy always seems to be thinking secret thoughts, hidden truths about people. Like a psychic elf or something. What? John says, as Zelenka regards him behind his glasses. Zelenka's clutching at a stack of papers, wearing a lab coat that looks like it might double as a home for some stray animal, and watching John without blinking. You are helping Rodney get out of tournament? He blinks and shifts his stance a little. Now he's just an able administrator and brilliant engineer, nothing creepy or paranormal about him. I don't think I have a choice in the matter. That was the conclusion he drew as soon as Rodney opened his mouth about it, but he had to fight the battle. Surrender's always the last resort. John usually does what Rodney wants, after exhausting every avenue to avoid it. Hmm, Zelenka says, and consults his watch. That is disappointing. I was hoping he would go down in flames. John thinks about Zelenka's hockey scores and would lay even odds that Zelenka was going to break the tournament to get even. He's sneaky. John respects that. He thinks Rodney probably deserves it for all the shit Zelenka puts up for him. Also, Zelenka continues, half turning to go, forgive him when he misbehaves. He was socialized in physics lab, not really his fault. He smiles and wanders away. That must have been a blessing or something, because John's already seen the worst of Rodney and he's still right here, waiting for the asshole to come back from some meeting that was supposed to take 15 minutes and it's been 2 hours. That's fine, John's got a lot of reports. And Tetris. He has daydreams about waking up without pain and getting back to active duty so he doesn't have so much time on his hands to think. To think about the honest-to-God fear in Rodney's eyes when he mumbles about the surgery and John sits tight-lipped and swallowing down bile. To think about what comes next and all the worst-case scenarios that just tailspin into worse and worse. Rodney's fears follow John like a contrail and he can't fix anything, so he wishes Rodney would keep it to himself.
I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Big Rock Candy Mountain plays low, building to a crescendo. Fish sticks. I got peanut butter on the last Daedalus run. I'd trade all the Ethosian souls for a White Castle. Cadbury, but don't tell McKay, he's got a serious fiend on for Flake. I never thought the day would come I'd honestly say I dream about decent French fries. Real Chex Mix, you know, with Worcestershire sauce and garlic. I would trade myself to the Genii if they had a Tim Hortons franchise on one of their worlds. John gets his stitches out the day of the tournament. Well, the first day of it. Rodney is off-world with Cadman's team and Simpson and a couple other math people. John's never sure what some of the science people actually do. Some seem to just mill around and get yelled at by Rodney and glared at by Zelenka. Some seem to mainly play cards with the Marines. He's drinking some coffee and shooting the shit with Lorne when the gate engages and Jackson comes through slapping his clothes and waving his hat. Three other people follow behind him doing likewise. Oh my fucking god, chiggers, one of the anthropologists shouts. Jackson whips his shirt off and sort of claws at his waistband. John watches a couple of women become seriously interested in the proceedings. He rolls his eyes, but watches himself. Hey, he's got eyes in his head. John hits his comm. Med team to the gate room. Almost immediately, Carson answers back. John, you just got your stitches out. What did you do? Are you all right, lad? Jiggers, off-world team. I'm fine. The whole team's about down to their undie. One of them, the French chick, Dr. Pouillon, is wearing a red bra and green panties. Weirdly festive. Lauren leans in to murmur, I think I'm getting old and jaded, because I just don't give two shits about getting a free show most people will pay sticky dollar bills for. John laughs and concurs. Amusingly, the gate redials, and the underwear-clad anthropologists have to scramble away from the event horizon so they don't all end up footy stubs instead of living people. They run, half the room watching Jackson, the other Pouillon, and the gate whooshes back to life. Oh, you must be joking, Rodney screeches as he materializes. Simpson's right behind him with that super-still, angry face some women get before they set your stuff on fire and run over your dog. I didn't see you figuring it out either, and you're not my thesis advisor, so you better stop treating me like you own me, or one day you're going to find lemon rinds in your coffee filter. She stomps off. The people in underwear are momentarily forgotten as the entire room, including the underwear-clad people, are riveted by Rodney getting his ass handed to him by a waspy blonde woman. Assert your independence, then. You were still wrong. Rodney doesn't sound angry anymore, though, maybe surprised and mildly amused. Oh, I see. There are orgies while I'm off-world working myself into an early grave to defeat the Ori? Sad news. And Dr. Golden sounds truly saddened. Balderdash tournament postponed until Dr. Jackson gets out of the infirmary. John finds Rodney later in the evening, when the sun's set fully, the long Atlantean day finally giving up its existence to the night. He's leaning against a whiteboard that's more Greek letters than numbers, hunched over his laptop with a dry erase pen clenched in his teeth and a pencil behind his ear. The side of his neck along his hairline is sunburned, like his sunscreen sweated off in patches. The lab's almost empty. John assessed the room by habit as soon as the door opened. Half the lights are off and the entire place has a dull, hollow feel to it, like the life's blood out to tumble into bed, leaving Rodney and Zelenka and Dr. Simpson to ignore each other. John crosses the room and he lays his hand on Rodney's neck next to the burn. Rodney doesn't flinch or move away, and he's not startled. I thought you were just going to stand there in a fugue state, he sighs. Rodney's exhausted and upset enough about something to skip the hysterics and move straight on to calm dread. John leans his hip on Rodney's shoulder and glances over the calculations on the board. Energy transfer and fluid dynamics. I thought you'd be glad the tournament was postponed. Rodney looks up at him, the dry erase marker now tossed on the worktop in front of him, stranded among the computer components and ancient crystals. The what? Rodney starts and cuts off to clamp his mouth in a firm line. Oh, that. Minor personal catastrophe put on hiatus due to the looming greater universal catastrophe of running out of power to keep up the city's shields. He looks up at John with his eyes wide open and blinks like John's got some kind of answer, like he's going to just pull that ZPM right out of his pocket and fork it over. Rodney doesn't trust many people, but apparently when he does, it's blind trust. And John wants nothing more than to live up to those unattainable expectations, but he's just a guy. He's a guy who fucks up a lot, and he's never felt so acutely aware of that as he has lately. He wants to save Atlantis. Hell, they all want that. But so much more importantly, he doesn't want to let Rodney down. He let Elizabeth down. Come on, you're not going to solve the mysteries of the conservation of energy right now, and I'm tired. John pushes back and Rodney steadies him with a huge hand on John's hip when he sways slightly. Okay, fine, fine. Let me just... Rodney starts typing furiously and John almost snatches the machine away, but he doesn't want to pull back a nub. I'm going to take measures in 5, 4, 3. John looks at his watch like he's really timing it. Rodney rolls his eyes and saves his work. All right, all right. You're such a pain in... Radic! Rodney stands up, rolling his neck. Zelenka's head pops up from behind a computer. Go to bed and tell that harpy Simpson to get a beauty sleep because she needs it. John sighs and shakes his head. Good night, Colonel Shepard, Dr. Simpson calls from somewhere on the far side of the room. John waves in her direction. Night, Simpson. Just ignore Rodney. Fiddle music plays, something close to a reel, but off somehow, the meter not quite right. People clap, and feet tap the ground. Play the Athosian song about the Lantan Tan, Katie, Dr. Parrish calls out. Okay, wait, Dr. Brown answers. A finger slides across a string, emitting a high-pitched, resonant twang. All right, here we go. The music picks back up as the botany department dances. Three days later is Elizabeth's birthday, and Atlantis takes this as a holiday, only a skeleton crew left in the gate room, rotating throughout the day. John lights an Athosian lamp at the memorial service and watches the flame flicker, exposed and delicate, but with the power to bring humanity from one level of development to another, fitting somehow to have so many open flames in memory of Elizabeth. The rotunda in the Atlas Tower flickers with shadows cast by 173 flames, one each for all of them. Rodney lit his and left. John and Taylor have been sitting quietly side by side, cross-legged on the warm stone floor for hours. She's probably meditating and communing with the dead. John's glad to have her with him, her solid, steady presence reminding him in some ways of Elizabeth. Maybe just because she's a strong woman in a way that doesn't demand attention to how strong she is. John's never understood women of any kind, but the ones who ask for more burdens, who volunteer to account for other people's lives, those sorts of women are like hieroglyphs to him. When you already are burdened with so much, for mothering and bearing children, for having to fix relatives and lovers, why take on more? Why take on the world when there's already so much they have to be responsible for that no one even asks about or notices? John doesn't understand that. All of his burdens he has shouldered willingly, because it was the right thing to do, but he wasn't born with the expectation that he would already there. John took on Elizabeth as his responsibility, and then he failed. At some point, Ronan walks through the crawling shadows and drops to the floor on John's free side. He sits like John and Taylor for a spell, and then folds over to press his forehead to the floor, murmuring to himself. Taylor opens her eyes and watches him, her eyes holding John's when he turns his head to watch her. He wonders how much of their serenity is real, and how much of it is a projection of what everyone around them wants to see. The noble savages. Taylor turns her palms up on her knee, and John takes it. Reader's note here, the following Atlantis podcast is, I'm not completely sure, I believe it's Arabic, and obviously I can't read that. I'm sorry I can't read it. Moving on. John's cleared for duty, but he's already been working pretty steadily for a couple weeks. He's not training, no jogging or stick fights with Taylor, but he oversees the drills and wears his gun again. No one even pretends Jackson is really in charge from what John can tell. It's as if without Elizabeth, people don't feel the need to respect any kind of real authority. They're in another galaxy anyway. They aren't at war anymore, and they have no need to substitute personal desires for the greater good. People don't blindly follow in Atlantis. Jackson himself seems to just sign anything Zelenka or Jeanette puts in front of him. The science teams and support staff run independently, a certain kind of natural autonomy that John himself assumes for the military personnel. This is how John sees it. Atlantis is their city, and as much as they all technically work for the U.S. government or some international oversight, whatever, who knows when things will go to shit, and they'll be stuck out here alone with only themselves. Best to just let the cards fall where they will and figure out how to keep on keeping on. Jackson just likes to dig things up and coo over books anyway. He's a nerd like all the other scientists. John sees a leader in him, saw it during the Genai conflict, and he thinks when the time comes, Jackson will earn everyone's respect by getting his own blood and other people's on his hands. John already respects him for not trying to take Elizabeth's place and finding his own way to fit in. John's still aching inside, oh the metaphor, when the Daedalus arrives for its scheduled rendezvous with planet Atlantis. John's there to greet Colonel Caldwell, all meet and greet, and Caldwell is Caldwell. Here. He hands John a military-issued jewelry case that John knows contains his silver eagles. That's that. Good old Caldwell. Thanks, John says. What you did was reckless but human. I respect you, Colonel Shepard. And John realizes everyone was right about Caldwell having a thing for Elizabeth. Way to ruin the moment, Caldwell. Alrighty. John almost salutes, instead sticks his hand out for a manly shake and turns away to appear busy supervising. Rodney's watching him from over the top of his datapad, eyebrows up and sarcasm all over his face. John didn't know sarcasm could be a facial expression until he met Rodney. Now he sort of enjoys trying to reflect that back at him. They can have a facial expression off. Balderdash? What? John hears behind him. Caldwell's obviously being railroaded by Jackson, who laughs full-throated and pleased with himself. Situation normal. Rodney's in a snit, Jackson's acting dumb to pull someone's leg, and John's twitching to get into the air. And that's the end. Reader's notes. The podcast that I was unable to read were Hebrew and Arabic prayers. The music featured in this podfic are You're Ahead by a Century by The Tragically Hip, Winter Wonderland by Bing Crosby, The Collection of Mary Claire by Daniel Lanois, Egypt by Kate Bush, Barrett's Privateers by Stan Rogers, and Big Rock Candy Mountains by Soggy Bottom Boys. Thanks to Ether Seaman for letting me podcast this. I love this fic, and I loved doing it. It took quite a while. It's very long and difficult to pronounce quite a few things, but it was an education, and it was fun. So, that's it. Hope you enjoyed.